History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there that should never go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to invest a little time and a little attention to ask some questions, and then, of course, be patient enough to listen as long-buried memories start to rise up to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We really want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we start out with those intentions, it really is amazing what happens, because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. All around America this week, of course, families gathered to celebrate Thanksgiving. And I don't know about you, but sometimes it's hard for me to slow down enough to take a full inventory of all the things that I really should view with gratitude. One thing that I'm really thankful for is the willingness of all of these amazing veterans who trust us enough to share their stories here, perhaps without realizing just how significant a gift they're giving to the rest of us. Some of the memories we've heard on Hometown Heroes involve experiencing Thanksgiving during World War II, when so many of our service members wondered if they'd ever get to sit down for a real holiday meal with their family again. And here in 2021, I know many families sat down this past week with an empty chair, their first Thanksgiving without a very special member of their family. One family at the forefront of my mind this past week was the Sanchez family in Southern California. Earlier this year, we introduced you to William Sanchez, who had spent most of World War II as a prisoner of war after being captured on Corregidor in May of 1942. This past Wednesday, November 24th, the day before Thanksgiving, Mr. Sanchez was laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery, an honor fitting for a man whose 103 years on this planet were marked by courage, kindness, and dignity. Mr. Sanchez spent 39 months in the absence of freedom during the prime of his life, relying each one of those days on his faith and his will to survive. And here's what he told us about that moment when he finally tasted freedom again.
It was a great feeling just to be free. It was just something you experience once in a lifetime. Freedom. You realize what the word freedom really means.
The late William Sanchez laid to rest this week at Arlington National Cemetery. On our last episode, we met a 100-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor who had endured the sinking of his second ship nearly a year after those attacks on Oahu. I don't think we're quite going to experience deja vu this week, but it will definitely be a parallel story this coming week as we prepare to mark the 80th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Our friends at the Best Defense Foundation will be taking 60 World War II veterans on a free week-long journey to Oahu to mark that occasion. Among those 60 are 9 veterans who we've gotten to meet here on Hometown Heroes. Follow the Best Defense Foundation's social media channels for updates on that special endeavor. I have the links for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And let's get familiar with one of those special veterans over the next hour. David Russell, or simply Russ, as his friends call him, turned 101 in September. He'll be going back to a place where his life nearly came to a tragic end at age 21 on December 7th, 1941. Before we hear Russ's Pearl Harbor story, though, let's hear about his childhood in Auburn, Nebraska.
It's a little town of 2,000 with a lot of lightning and thunder.
Gets a little windy out there?
Very windy. You flew kites in March because we had wind.
You probably hear the corn stalks rustling when it gets windy, huh?
You can hear that corn grow.
You can hear the corn grow?
Yes, it grows so fast that the humidity back there caused that corn to grow, I think. I don't know. But
how would I recognize the sound of corn growing? What does it sound like?
You can just hear it when you're out there. You can just, maybe it's the wind making it. But
yeah? Like Rice Krispies or something? A little snap, crackle, pop?
There you go.
And what was your childhood like there? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had 2 brothers and a sister. Both of them were in the military during World War II. One was Navy and one was Coast Guard.
You're a pretty young boy when the Great Depression hits America. What were those years like for your family? What are the things you remember?
Hungry. We were always hungry.
Do you remember in those years some dreams, some ambitions, some thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this?
I wanted to join the Navy. I wanted to get away from that little community. Sometimes that I'm dreaming about that or thinking about it when I go back to bed. For some reason, you go back to your childhood days. You think back, like, after the Pearl Harbor deal and yeah. The war years, you know, think some of the things you forgot about, it comes back to you.
I'm sure some of those memories are haunting, and it's not easy to think about it, not easy to deal with. Why the Navy? What was it about the Navy that made you want to join?
My dad had a friend who was a Navy man. He was in the Army with my dad. And then after the war one, he joined the Navy, and he'd come and visit my dad a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably the uniform at that time.
You liked the Navy uniform better than the Army?
Yes.
Thought the ladies would like it better?
That I don't know.
You mentioned your father serving in the Army in World War One. Did he ever tell you about any of that, the things that he did?
He told me a lot. He had his own horse at the time. It's something about the Rainbow Division. I don't know too much about it. But I remember him talking about dead horses. He saw so many dead horses when he was in the Army over there.
But you get this idea of joining the Navy, and you did so a long time before Pearl Harbor, more than 2 years before Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
What were those early days for you like in the Navy? What kinds of things did you do? Where did they send you?
After I got aboard ship, I was assigned to the 5th Division, which is the starboard side of the boat deck. Our duties then was to hoist boats in and out, and when we were underway, if they flew a seaplane, we were to retrieve it. And we had a sled with a cargo net on the back of it, and this pontoon had a hook on it. And when we'd make a real hard turn, the rough sea would turn really smooth, and this aircraft would land in the water and slide up on that sled and fell back till it hit that cargo net, and then we'd hoist it aboard. We got up at 5:30 in the morning. We'd scrub down the decks, wash the wash paint work, shine the bark work. And then we'd go down for breakfast, and then 8 o'clock, turn two again, then go back up and fight the rust. All ships have a lot of rust, you know, the salt water.
And this is the ship you're talking about here is the battleship USS Oklahoma?
Battleship Oklahoma,
And your uncle was on that ship?
He came aboard after I was on there. We were in San Francisco at the time at Hunter's Point, and he came aboard. That was in September, I think.
September of 41?
41, yeah.
Well, that had to be pretty special to have your uncle aboard. Not everybody has that.
Well, when I went broke, I knew where to go get some money.
And I guess we're so used to modern times, and of course it was World War II that gave us that policy after the 5 Sullivan brothers went down, but people aren't used to family members serving on the same ship or in the same unit. There were 23 pairs of brothers that died on the USS Arizona on December 7th. I interviewed a man here years ago who lost one of his brothers on the Oklahoma but survived, and here you're on the Oklahoma with your uncle. And what about all the other guys? What was the camaraderie like aboard that ship?
We had all our seamen were from different parts of the world, you know. We had people with Germans. We had Russians.
Really?
Yeah. We had people from all different states. I think we had every state in the United States, all those guys. And the Southerners, we had quite a few Southerners.
So pretty eye-opening for a young man from Nebraska to interact with all these guys.
Everything was different.
How about where you were stationed there at Pearl Harbor? Did you get to enjoy that island paradise a little bit?
Oh, yeah. We had sunshine every day, and the weather was perfect. We would operate during the week and come in on the weekends. Just before the war, we were our exercise was to take gun crews from other ships out, and we'd do a lot of firing, AA firing.
So you'd have a lot of practice.
We had a lot of practice.
But did you have any idea that a war was coming?
I saw my uncle was in the Air Force in Honolulu the night before. That was Saturday night.
And to be clear, this is a different uncle. So you've got an uncle that's on the ship with it. You also have another uncle stationed at Hickam Field just a few miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So you ran into him, the Air Force uncle.
That was my dad's brother also.
Uh-huh.
He told me that, he said, we'll be at war within 12 days. I was...
Really? So when he told you that, was that kind of a smack in the face? Was that a big eye-opener?
Well, they were talking about war because they were talking, they sent those dignitaries from Japan to Washington, D.C., and that was the big, you know.
Yeah.
That was the news in those days.
Right. They were there when Japan attacked you guys at Pearl. But did you believe him when he told you that? Did you think he knew what he was talking about?
The way the world was then, you know, after what Germany was doing, dominating everything they can get their hands on, is one of those things you think about, you know.
But when you went to sleep on Saturday night, December 6th, I'm sure you had no idea what you were going to wake up to the next day.
I thought we'd just go to work and do our work and have a holiday routine.
What really happened? What do you remember about that morning?
I was in the compartment just reading a book, and Lieutenant Rommel gets on the loudspeaker. He says, this is attack, fellas. And he didn't say this. He said an S word. And, boy, that woke us up. And about that time, those torpedoes start hitting us. And pow, 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 pow. The 9 of them hit us.
And where were you?
I was in the compartment. And those torpedoes just hit me, well, probably 80 feet from me and just across from me there.
So what did that feel like?
Oh, my goodness. You know, as clean as those ships were, dust. I don't know where the dust came from, but it probably come from the blowers, the air blowers.
Mm-hmm.
You started coughing, so much dust. It's unbelievable.
Well, it sure seems like there's nothing that could prepare you for this. And you're trying to figure out what in the world's going on probably, right?
Yeah, what do I do next? When he said air attack, I had 2 battle stations. If we came under air attack, I was to sink cover. I had to go down below decks, below the armor decks. And if we go to surface action, my battle station was the 5-inch 51s. They were in casemates alongside the ship.
Uh-huh. So where'd you go?
So air attack, I went down below decks. And I went down. That hatch I went through is 13.5 inches thick armor plate. From 13.5 inches down to 8 inches, 3/4 inch length of the ship. And they started to close the hatch. And I said, well, you know, my mind started operating. And I said, I've been trained to be a first loader on an anti-aircraft gun. In case somebody gets hurt, I can replace them. And by the time I got out of that ship, it was halfway over. It began to capsize, you know, right away.
Yeah, you said the number, 9 torpedoes, and that ship
several
starts...
Several bombs, yeah.
And it's starting to turn over, ends up tipping over something like 150 degrees, right? I mean, almost completely upside down.
And trying to get out of those compartments, you know, people were dogging, you know, they dog everything down, those hatches. There's 8 dogs on every hatch. It's not like these quick disconnect hatches that we have today. But I would try to undog them. Somebody else on the other side would dog them down. And then I had to climb over lockers. The concussion or the explosions caused those lockers to break loose. So I had to divert myself around to get out or climb over the lockers.
Could you see? Was it dark under there?
We had portholes when I got up on the main deck there, and they were still open.
Right, but you had to get up there first. So you're scrambling over fallen lockers. Is there water rushing in too?
See, we had battle lanterns also.
Right.
When we locked last Tuxedo, the battle lanterns went on.
Mm-hmm. I imagine there's just chaos all around you probably, right? You have other guys that are trying to figure out what they're trying to do or where they're going?
Well, it was pretty well organized. You know, we used so well trained, we had no problems. You know, people up starboard and down port.
Have you ever stopped to think about what if I hadn't made that decision to go topside when I did?
Those men are still down there. Yeah, they got trapped, yeah.
And of all the ships at Pearl Harbor, only the Arizona lost more men than the Oklahoma.
429 we lost. Mm-hmm. A lot of my friends. Mm-hmm.
What was going through your mind while this is happening?
Oh, everything goes, why did Japan do this? You know, why? Because it was warlords in Japan. They were different.
So when you did get to the surface or to the top of the ship, it's already starting to roll over?
The water just began to come over the main deck there. And the ship was... what, about 80 degrees?
Mm-hmm.
About ready to capsize there.
So if you're on the top, you're really on the side with the way the thing is turning.
Yeah, the deck is facing you, yeah.
Uh-huh.
The water hose coming across, I grabbed a water hose and just hand over hand myself up. Oh, then I went down over the side.
Because the ship's turning, you're basically climbing to get to what was the side, which is now the top, and then you slid off into the water?
No, the half-inch thick steel plates.
Uh-huh.
They were riveted together, so I just went down and got a hold of the edge of that, and I just gave one big leap, and I caught a line from the Maryland. We were tied alongside.
Uh-huh.
And I got a hold. See, there was fire coming down between the two ships.
Right.
From the Arizona, and I didn't want to get that water because I'm afraid that, you know, the way the wind was blowing that fire down, I thought, oh my, you know, I could see those guys walking in that fire and swimming in it, trying to push that oil away from them, but they just couldn't do it. But anyway, I called up on the to Maryland, and they were at general quarters. They're firing their 1.1 guns, anti-aircraft guns. So I just over there, and I wanted a few instructions on how to handle that ammunition. And I got it, and so I helped them pass ammunition.
I'm just thinking about this. So you were, what, 21 years old? Yeah, 21 years old.
I just turned 21.
And your ship has been almost sunk by now. It's about to go under.
Just the bottom of it sticking out.
And you've escaped that. You've got, you know, the water's on fire, basically, because all the oil from these other ships.
The fire was on the inboard side by the beach.
Uh-huh.
Between the two ships.
And there's all this, you know, everything else is going around here, too. I mean, the Arizona has had the big explosion. I'm sure there's smoke everywhere.
Oh, awful, yeah.
What are you hearing? What are you smelling?
The smoke. You could smell the smoke. Since I was down in the compartment, I didn't see the Arizona explode.
Right.
But I did see the destroyer Shaw when it went up in smoke.
Which was a more spectacular explosion.
Yeah, that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The photos of that are probably some of the most striking photos out there. It looks like fireworks going on.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I want to tell you another story.
Yeah.
At 7 o'clock in the morning, a high-test gasoline tanker for the fuel for the aircraft tied up just ahead of us. Nobody attacked that ship.
What would have happened if they did?
Oh, probably, I don't know. That high-test gas, you know how explosive that is.
Yeah, that's almost miraculous that it...
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm just trying to imagine being in your shoes, and I mean, you tell me that you go over to the Maryland and you jump into action and help them load ammunition for this big gun, but did you have any concept of what was really happening there or what had happened to the world?
Well, we knew we would go to war as soon as we sit around and just waiting for our orders to come in, where to go. We'd sit around talking about, what are they going to name this? Are they going to name this Pearl Harbor? So it turned out to be Pearl Harbor, yeah.
How long did that last with you helping them with that gun on the Maryland?
Not too long. Then from there, the Maryland wanted the Oklahoma sailors to leave, so I went over on the beach. And from the beach, I went up to the administration building. And that's when I got to see all the burnt. They were in the administration building. They just laid them in there.
Dead bodies.
Some were dead and some were dying. But most of them wanted to smoke, and I didn't smoke. So there was a Gedunk stand there in the center. We call it Gedunk stand, the place where they sell ice cream and cigarettes and stuff like that. And I went over and got a pack of cigarettes and some matches, and I lit their cigarettes for them.
That was your way of helping to console people who...
I didn't have any money, so I felt guilty doing what I did, but it was for a cause.
How hard was that to see? I mean, this is the human cost of war right in front of you.
When you see that flesh, it's awful. Yeah, it's... Not fun. You feel like you wish it was you instead of them. Yeah.
Understandably so. It is time for our first break, but we'll hear more of Russ Russell's story when we return. The 101-year-old is one of 60 World War II vets scheduled to fly to Pearl Harbor with the Best Defense Foundation to mark the 80th anniversary of that day of infamy. But December 7th is significant in Russ's life for more than just what happened on that date in 1941. Much more in store when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.